Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
The world works in certain ways until a new great idea comes along and changes everything.
We need a name.
We live.
We dream.
We work.
I'm Travis Kalanick, and I will never back down from a fight. And if no one wants to believe in me, I'll make them believe by being undeniable.
These kids don't overthink. They don't get bogged down about the way things have always been done. They want to change things now.
Hello and welcome back to Still Watching Downfall of the Startups. I'm Vanity Fair Chief Critic Richard Lawson. I'm here today with Vanity Fair Audio Editor Katie Rich.
Hi.
And Vanity Fair Staff Writer Julie Miller. Hello, ladies.
Hello.
So for those of you just joining us, this season of Still Watching is covering multiple shows centered on a similar theme. People who had a big idea, got rich, and then took a tumble. Just a reminder that if you have any questions or comments while you're listening, please do reach out to us at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. It can be a criticism. It can be a correction. We welcome those, as, you know, or if you just want to send us a love letter, that's fine too. So this is an exciting episode because we are welcoming a third series into the mix. For the past 2 weeks, we've just been talking about Showtime Super Pumped, about Uber and Hulu's The Dropout, about Theranos, and now we have Apple TV with We Crashed, which is about WeWork, the work-sharing company, and its founder, Adam Neumann, and his very interesting wife, Rebecca Neumann. That show premiered on Friday. All of these shows, you know, like I said, are about a business that we have heard a lot about in real life, but these shows offer us also a portrait of the personalities behind them. I don't know. I'm eager to hear from you two about what you think of We Crashed. I think we'll start there just because it's the new kid in the class. It's kind of more of a sentimental human drama for me than Super Pumped is, definitely, and maybe even The Dropout, even though in this episode of The Dropout, episode 5, we get into some really heavy emotional stuff. Katie, I'll start with you. How do you feel We Crashed fits into the triptych of these series?
Well, when you talk about it being sentimental, it's interesting because with The Dropout, you've got a convicted criminal in Elizabeth Holmes. And with Super Pumped, you've got a self-described asshole in Travis Kalanick. And it's not that Adam Neumann and Rebecca Neumann don't have asshole tendencies. And I think as the show goes on, you get to see many more of those. But especially meeting Adam Neumann in the first episode is this like striving hustler who just wants a project to succeed. And then Rebecca as Gwyneth Paltrow's overshadowed cousin, which we'll certainly talk more about. You feel for them and you kind of get where they're coming from, even though they're totally insane. And I think these performances from Jared Leto and Anne Hathaway, which I love, I think really go a long way toward that, too.
I agree. I I was captivated because, in spite of what you think of Adam and of Rebecca, I believe in their love so much. So it was oddly to me a little bit like there's an undercurrent of love story there, which I was intrigued by. And that's, you know, in part because of the chemistry between Jared Leto and Anne Hathaway, both of whom have said that in talking to Adam and Rebecca and learning about them, they really believe in that love. So I was struck by that. And I also like the idea that we're in New York, we're not in Silicon Valley for this one. Yeah. So we get a different perspective, which I appreciate.
Wait, did you say that they interviewed Adam and Rebecca Newman for this show? I realized I should have done my research, but I didn't know that.
Well, Jared tracked down Adam, and he wasn't going to tell anyone about it. He visited all the Newmans at their home, but Adam, in an interview, confessed that Jared came over, so the cat was sort of out of the bag in that sense. But Jared Leto, did you know, has his own tech history? He was an early investor in YouTube and Airbnb and was profiled by the Wall Street Journal. In 2017, he said he cold calls startups all the time and is always hunting for that next acquisition, which is just a wonderfully interesting, you know, addition to his resume. But I thought that was fascinating. Anne was a little bit more, I think she implied that she had maybe had a conversation, but she had definitely had conversations with people around Rebecca. She said she had a few mutual friends in common with her. And
the idea of Jared. A cold call from Jared Leto sounds like something that could happen on Super Pumped if he wasn't currently on a different show, right? Doesn't that fit into the world?
I would love that story arc where Jared Leto appears on Super Pumped as himself.
Or some poor actor has to take on the unenviable task of playing Jared Leto, which, like, how do you do that?
Yeah, the energies can never match.
Something that I think is so interesting about We Crashed as it relates to these two other shows, you know, on Super Pumped, you have the brash, you know, macho kind of thing. And, you know, and I think that that's reflective of the showrunners, you know, their previous work on Billions. The Dropout is a little more sensitive, more of a kind of moral thriller in a way. And then We Crashed because there's, I mean, we're seeing, you know, Rebecca, especially in episode 3, moving into this wellness language, this spiritual language. There's something softer about it, which it doesn't mean that there's not, like, bad things happening. It just kind of is coming at it from a different angle, especially as this company, as we see it on the show and in episode 2, Adam has this lovely soliloquy at a JP Morgan event about, like, we're not, you know, selling you work or something, we're selling you a life, you know, basically. And everyone gets sort of enwrapped by that idea. And so I like the way that this show links into other trends in, like, millennial and Gen Z culture, which is, like, that kind of woo-woo sort of world in a way that the other two shows don't. Because Elizabeth Holmes is much, much more of a pragmatist. A liar, yes, but, like, she wouldn't get caught up in all this spiritual stuff the way that the Newmans do.
Yeah, we've talked about the needle drops on The Dropout already, but We Crash really has its share of them, and less like mid-aughts like Elizabeth Holmes in college and more like MGMT to put you in 2009. And I don't know if you guys felt personally attacked by those period piece markings, but I sure did.
I love in the first episode, aren't they listening to a song in the car and then the assistants all have it queued up once they walk into the office itself? It's amazing.
Well, and it's Katy Perry's Roar, and we saw in The Dropout last week where Firework played a really major role for the Walgreens execs. So is Katy Perry the patron saint of these shows?
Yeah, well, certainly one of the patron saints of that era. You know, we're talking about the late aughts, the early 2010s, and I think that, you know, we're all in our 30s, late 30s, for some of us anyway. And I think that, like, that is something really interesting that both The Dropout and We Crash do in particular, which is, like, it's about these scandals and these larger-than-life characters, but it's also just about, like, what it in some ways felt to be cognizant of, like, media and tech and those huge burgeoning worlds, like, at that time, you know? So it's about these specific people, but it's all about, it's more like, this is what culture was sort of pointed at. And so you have to have the Katy Perry's or the MGMT songs to kind of score that, because it really grounds you in that sense memory, I suppose.
Yeah.
Right. So we crashed. There's such unbridled excess. It's such a stark counterpoint to Theranos and Elizabeth's world, which feels so constricted and regimented.
Well, because their aims were different, you know, right. Like, I think it would be interesting, you know, if we could talk a little bit about, like, well, we can also talk about the performances, you know, because Jared Leto's doing a lot, Amanda Seyfried's doing a lot, and we see her, you know, she's really developing the performance in episode 5 even further. Like, what do you think the motivations, how do they differ, I guess, in your minds? Like, because they both kind of want to do a little bit of world domination, but maybe that's sourced in different places for them.
That's interesting because they do both have this wild-eyed sense of, like, they'll look someone in the eye and be like, I will change the world. And they mean it. And they convince people that they mean it. And their demeanors really couldn't be more different. And, you know, the way that they're running their workplaces. But maybe it's that desire to dominate the world. Like, that's the Silicon Valley theme. It's something that Travis Kalanick on Super Pumped has, too, where they're just so convinced of their power and how persuasive they could be and have this incredible success as a result of it. And for some of them, like, hoodwink people into thinking they really know what they're doing.
Right. And Elizabeth, she was sort of micro-focused on Theranos, but Adam, at least reading about him, seemed maybe broader in his delusions. On top of WeWork, he had all of these. He talked about wanting to become the president of the world, the prime minister of Israel. He wanted to live forever and was investing in these companies to extend the duration of human life. I guess he had more ambitions, more out of the box ambitions, maybe.
Yeah, and they don't seem to have been, I mean, spoiler alert, sorry, but in real life, like, they, now that they're out of the company, Rebecca and Adam, from everything I've read, including a piece in Vanity Fair by Rachel Dodds, like, they haven't really stopped with that ideation, you know, I don't think that this season of television is going to be about them, like, having the come to Jesus moment and learning that, like, okay, maybe I need to scale back my ambition. I think that it's actually a different story, which is kind of interesting. And I love the way, though, that Leto plays it, is that, like, and the way that they frame Rebecca as she's kind of our surrogate, in that, like, we watch in the first episode as she's sort of won over by him. And I'll speak for myself. I kind of was too. He's charming, even though I know that behind the scenes there was, like, you know, a lot of sort of megalomania happening.
Oh, yeah.
That's what's so fascinating. And if you read the Wall Street Journal's write-ups of him, even these executives who hated him, his management style at the end, couldn't help concede that he did have this special charisma and charm and was incredible about motivating employees, even if, you know, his management overall was totally misguided. Whereas it's just interesting, again, then to flip back to Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos, and she's trying to cheer on her employees in a much different way.
Go ahead, Julie.
Oh, no, go on.
There's a scene in the first episode of We Crashed, and I don't want to just, like, quote all my favorite lines, but it's tempting to because there's so many good moments. But there's a scene that's really only in there to show you how charming Adam is, where he's in the elevator with a neighbor and he's like, hey, you want to come over for Chinese food? And then just eats the guy's dinner and gets the guy to bring over the beer and the soy sauce. And, like, he gets absolutely what he wants. And the guy's like, okay, sure.
It's amazing.
And
you read the books about him, and that was a real life experience that helped inform him of what he wanted to develop with WeWork. He had moved into this Tribeca apartment with his sister, who was an actual supermodel and was, like, booking photo shoots in Russian Vogue. And he couldn't understand. He had moved to America when he was 22, and he just didn't understand why people in her apartment building weren't friendly. So they really did start this contest about who could befriend more neighbors in the building, and she did win because she was a supermodel. But he said, or at least he was very good about incorporating that thread in his narrative when he would then talk to investors about how that was how, like, the idea for WeWork and that communal setting sort of developed.
Julie, you've done a lot of, you've opened the door, I think, to sort of we're not going to fact check, but I'm just sort of curious how We Crashed aligns with the truth. There's some stuff in these first three episodes that, like you said, the competition about meeting neighbors, like, that's fascinating to know that was actually real. But then you get to the third episode where they're at camp and this horrible, successive series of things happens with Rebecca.
But that didn't look fun, Richard? That summer camp didn't look like a good time to you?
Yeah, I mean, everything up till the listening session. and I found an article from a New York Times writer, I believe it's Marissa Metzler, that was at camp in 2014. So, but it's not, you know, obviously she didn't go leave and work for WeWork, I don't think. So it's a lot of, I feel like a lot of that episode is maybe invented.
I want to interrupt for a second, though, because I did look at that article, too, and there's a shot of a canoe full of beer that is replicated exactly in the episode. So there are some details that I know are real.
That's incredible. I read another, I think it was Wall Street Journal. They said that there was another retreat in London, and the bartender was giving out free rosé, but not by the glass, by the bottle. He was just handing out these bottles. It was incredible. And you look at the excess and all the tequila that they were spending, like as a line item in the budget, all that, I think it was 1942 tequila. Just, it was incredible, incredible excess. I don't have more details about the exact retreat.
I did find that, I think it was in 2018 at a retreat where she said the line about a big part of being a woman is to help men manifest their calling. And the Marissa Meltzer article you're talking about, Richard, is in 2014. So I think there's, you know, it's all true, but there's some, maybe some timeline fudging happening there just to make
sense. So she in fact said it much later in the WeWork.
Yes. Yeah. They were even more powerful when she said it.
But his drinking did get so out of control that he did pare back in later years at WeWork, and they credited Rebecca with helping do a lot of that just because he was in full-blown party mode in the first part of that era. There's this story about, in 2016, Adam had to fire 7% of the WeWork staff. A few weeks later, he held an all-hands meeting to talk about the staff cuts to everybody and sort of buoy morale after that. So he had this huge speech. I'm sure it was very charming and invigorating, as Leto portrays all those speeches to be. And then everyone received tequila shots that were passed out in plastic shot glasses from employees serving trays with trays of these shots. And again, this is 2 weeks after 7% of the staff were laid off. And as if that wasn't tone deaf enough, he then introduced Daryl McDaniels of Run DMC to come in and play a set for staff. And some of these staff members are quoted as saying that they were just incredulous and shocked and confused. And then others just embraced the moment and were doing the tequila shots and dancing along. So I think, you know, there is an accuracy to the tone deafness and that sort of millennial excess, if that makes sense.
I don't want to spoil the show for anybody, but we may see more of that moment in later episodes of We Crashed.
Ooh, enticing. Yeah, I mean, watching, you know, at this point with The Dropout, we are so far down the rabbit hole with that I don't really have to do the thought experiment of, like, would I buy it? Because, like, I think really only the diehards at that point were, or the ones who had a ton of money invested were. But I think what's something that's so poignant about these first three episodes of We Crashed is that, like, you know, the third episode begins with this sort of montage of this young woman who's a new employee, and it's her going through, like, the I mean, it's basically like, I don't know, a year in college almost, like, it just condensed, where she's so excited, meets all these new friends, drinking, partying, then gets tired, and then becomes really burnt out and disillusioned, and then at the very end just kind of buys back in. But I think they really were, the Newmans, at least as depicted on this show, tapping into a very common want at that time, which was like, I don't want to do the conventional thing. Maybe it was hastened by, like, Instagram. You're trying to live a life that looks aesthetically pleasing, but, like, I don't know. Do you either of you think you would have been, like, into this whole scene? Because there were parts of it where I thought, oh, absolutely not, I wouldn't want to be at that camp. But other aspects of it, I mean, I used to work at Gawker, and there was something of that feel to it in 2008 or 9, you know? So I'm curious about how that reads to you too.
Yeah, you think about, like, the loneliness of being young in New York too, right? About trying to find your place, you know, and having a workplace that's full of people who look just like you. And that post 2008, you know, culture from which WeWork comes, where they're able to get all this really cheap office space because of the recession. A lot of people were just kind of searching around for something. I definitely think I would have been susceptible to it. And, you know, Richard, you and I lived in New York in this period, like, because we could have gone and worked for WeWork and we didn't. So maybe we're smarter, or maybe, you know, that it just change one thing in my life and I could have wound up there.
Oh my, what a missed opportunity for you both. I would love to see that sliding glass or sliding doors version of your lives at that moment. But I feel the same way to be in a city that big and to feel that alone. There is something sexy about being surrounded by people your age in an environment like that. And Adam's charisma just seemed so infectious. I don't know that I would have been able to resist. He would end these speeches to his staff saying that he wanted to really change the world and end world hunger. And I can imagine being an impressionable 20-something thinking that, you know, it's good, nice to be a part of something big like that. It was interesting speaking to Jared about it because he said that one of the key elements he was able to bring to the performance that he doesn't think maybe another actor would have been able to was those communication skills from the stage, because Jared has all that experience on stage singing with his band 30 Seconds to Mars. So he said that there was something, and that to him was one of the most interesting and fascinating elements of Adam's appeal and charisma, was his ability to speak to those masses of people like he's talking to them one-on-one.
Can we talk about Jared Leto's contacts and what it does?
Oh, I would love to.
His character, because I think it makes a huge difference, and I think he's really good on this show, and like I had mixed feelings about him in House of Gucci, but I think the transformation really works.
It does. I mean, look, we'll just put it on the table. He is significantly older than Adam Newman is at this time in history. But I think something about Jared Leto's inherent oddness, which he puts to great use in some things, and then in other things it's a little bit harder to get on his wavelength. But like that sort of outsider, big dreamer, oddball, but with a warmth, a sort of inviting, you know, charisma, is a natural fit for this. I don't know what Adam Newman was like in real life. I've watched some interviews with him on YouTube, and you know, Leto's getting the voice right, the kind of bearing right. But it does that look, that intensity, those contact lenses, like there's something really creepy about it, but also at the same time, it's vampiric. It's like I've been glamored, you know, like I recognize that the thing is bad, but then all of a sudden I forget that. And then here I am at camp, you know, face down in the lake.
I would be too distracted by the blueness of his eyes, so I sort of needed these shields, these contact lenses to shield me from that.
And you think if he was as good looking as Jared Leto, even though Jared Leto was older, like he wouldn't have struggled so much in the early days? Like there's something about that paves the path.
Maybe, yeah. And I think that there's an echo there with Rebecca Paltrow Newman, where she's got this impossibly glamorous, beautiful old, you know, older cousin who's a famous actor. I mean, you know, and you know, Rebecca Newman is she's a pretty woman, but like I think that something about Adam's confidence to sort of, you know, stand 150% in what he has and just let that be enough or more than enough, I think that must be that in the psychology of this show, at least, like that's appealing to her, because she keeps trying and failing, and here's this wagon that not only she can hitch her star to, but the wagon is saying, no, sit next to me, you know, how inviting for someone who's really been struggling to find their place. And especially in reference to their cousin, who I was reading when Rebecca Paltrow was at college, everyone on campus knew her as Gwyneth Paltrow's cousin. And that messes with you after a while, I would imagine.
Right. And Gwyneth has spoken about Rebecca, which I find so fascinating, because Rebecca was born almost a decade after her three siblings, which I feel like informs a little bit maybe how she became who she is, at least depicted as being in this show. So Gwyneth said that she was, to her family, like this beautiful surprise princess. She was very much like a gift to the family and treated as such. So then to go out into the world as an adult, having been coddled that way and not treated, I guess, like your cousin Gwyneth, I could definitely understand the hurt in that. And Gwyneth has also spoken about Adam. She said, "I adore Adam, but he's a handful. It felt like Adam could explode at any moment when Rebecca wasn't around." which I just thought was interesting.
Is this where we get into detail about her her Chekhov performance in episode two, I loved more the second time around. One of my favorite things I've seen on TV all year.
You are braver than me. So I had watched the episode a couple weeks ago and then rewatched it so we could do this episode of the podcast. And when I got to that, I said, nope, and hit the 10 second. Once was enough. I mean, that is devastating. Do we know, did that actually happen? Or some version of it? I know she was a struggling actor and had made a couple short films on her own, but I'm curious about that specific production with Julie White as the director.
I don't know about that production. I know that she filmed a feature with Rosario Dawson in a WeWork office. Katie, do you know? Do you know about the Chekhov performance? Find this out. Okay.
I don't. I mean, honestly, I was just thinking about how I would drive my car at the Oscars. Like, it's just quite a season for Chekhov.
For Chekhov, really. That's true.
But also, I mean, the way, like, the Russian accent thing in the performance is its own level of cringe, but also her, like, her entitled swanning in, being like, oh, hello, I'm going to give you all this money to make your theater. And then, oh, wait, you still wanted to do that? I'm over it. I'm moving on. Like, it's so funny. Anne Hathaway playing a bad actor, because I think she's a very good actor. And this proves it, because that whole second episode that's kind of, it's called Masha, Masha, Masha. It's really Rebecca's episode, like, from her getting married in that purple dress. To that Russian accent. This thing is so flawless and such a great, like, you know, villain arrival for Rebecca in a way.
I love the purple dress. I want to know if it really happened. I couldn't find any details. So if anybody who's listening was at that wedding, we would love to know whether that's true or false.
The $1 million check was real. I know that much, which is kind of fascinating, especially because apparently at some point in Rebecca Paltrow Newman crafting her mythos, she started saying that she, you know, grew up off a dirt road and a sort of treehouse kind of thing. And Gwyneth Paltrow actually has said in a magazine article about Rebecca, like, no, she grew up well off. Like, Gwyneth Paltrow corrected the record on that, which is really interesting. But yeah, I mean, the acting stuff, and then we see it again in episode three, where she's at the acting class, I presume in Los Angeles, and she's doing the scene, it doesn't work, and then she taps into this rage over an ex-boyfriend. But before that, when she's just doing the scene from the first time, Anne Hathaway is doing a really good job of playing someone who, like, isn't a good actor, but maybe in high school or even college was told, oh yeah, she was pretty good, you know, like, mm-hmm. she's not awful, she's not Waiting for Guffman. And I think that's really hard to get right, and Hathaway nails it, probably because she spent so much time from childhood on, like, in theaters, in a local theaters, Paper Mill Playhouse, New Jersey, all that, just absorbing maybe people like that, frankly.
Yeah.
So before we move over to a little bit of The Dropout and Super Pumped, Katie, you have an interview for us. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So we've been talking all this time about Adam and Rebecca Newman, but there was a co-founder of WeWork we have not mentioned yet. And with good reason. Miguel McKelvey co-founded WeWork with Adam Newman and was really kind of the, like, quiet, I don't want to say brains behind the operation, but, you know, you see him in the show played by Kyle Marvin, you know, telling Adam to stop spending so much money and trying to handle Rebecca's PR crisis when she says that women are meant to support their husbands. And he's such a warm, inviting person. And as I asked Kyle Marvin in this conversation, you kind of watch it being like, why is he in business with this guy? Like, what did he see in Adam Newman other than the charisma we all talk about? So I talked to Kyle Marvin about it. And he is fascinating because he is an actor. He also acted in and co-wrote a film that was at Cannes in 2019 called The Climb, and is currently directing the movie 80 for Brady with Tom Brady, Jane Fonda, Rita Moreno, Sally Field, and Lily Tomlin. So this guy's career is really going places.
Wow.
I zoomed with him from his trailer on the set of that movie, and, you know, talked to him about that very wide range of career options and about Miguel McKelvey and how a guy like that winds up in this mess. So let's listen to it.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then, I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You can earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
So we're here to talk about the first three episodes of We Crash, since they are all premiering at the same time on Apple. And we get through all three of these episodes and just this overwhelming sense of Miguel McKelvey as this really good guy. And my question for you, and maybe the question of the entire series for you, is how does someone like him wind up with Adam Newman in the first place? Did you come up with a good answer to that question for yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea of success is intoxicating to anyone. Mm-hmm. And I think particularly when success comes in a partnership with someone else, you kind of assign the positive sort of way that things are going to either that person or you and that person together. And I think once you put your feet on that train, it's hard to get off, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? And I think that it's partially about the fact that, like, we see all of these events sort of from an exterior view where we can sort of be judgmental or not or whatever and look at this at a distance. But sometimes when you're in those things, you don't really see it, you know mm-hmm. what I mean? Because you're taking it incrementally until, you know, as the series shows, eventually you really do see it. And by then, you know, you see what's coming, the train that's already coming right at you. And I think it's more of that. I think it's more that the ideals of what they were talking about, co-working and being together and community and love and partying and all that stuff, sounds great. You know what I mean? It really sounds great. But when you put that up against giant scale and you put that up against time, that's where I think things got a little off the rails.
Yeah, and I feel like the power of the show, maybe especially in these first three episodes, is you're meeting Adam and Rebecca and, you know, to a lesser extent Miguel, because he does seem like a solid person, and you see all of their problems, but you're also won over by them at the same time. Like, you see the power of charisma. It really, it's real, you know? People can get talked into doing a lot of things. And I like the balance that the show is already striking of rooting for them despite knowing the train that's going to crash at the end of it, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the real interesting way to approach one of these stories, because it's easy to vilify these people. They've sort of already been lambasted by the media. So I think it's interesting to take a more nuanced approach to the characters, and it's something that Jared and Annie, you know, built into their performance, and it organically sort of fit in mine and then fit in the story as we sort of explored it. But I think it's the more interesting way to approach it, especially for people who aren't, you know, as hip to exactly what happened in all of the, like, details of the story. Mm-hmm. You can kind of get swept up in it in those first three episodes and sort of find yourself on the journey, and only to find yourself sort of struggling as you head into those, you know, episodes 4, 5, and 6, struggling with the same issues they're struggling with, which is like, oh, wait, maybe this isn't what it appears. You know what I mean? Maybe there's other stuff going on that's not great. You know?
Yeah. What are your memories of this period of WeWork? I believe you were working at an ad agency at some point, maybe in the WeWork rise. So we're in the New York media creative landscape. Was WeWork on your radar?
I was. You mean me personally? I was just thinking my character, and then I realized, oh yeah, I actually was. Yeah, good job on your research. I was working in commercial advertising, and so I was in production. I mean, it was definitely around. It's so weird because a ton of my peers had WeWork spaces.
Oh, I mean, yeah.
It was sort of the space to go to if you were small and scrappy and were trying to do something, particularly in LA and New York. So I'd been in tons of WeWorks because mm-hmm. friends had stuff there. I never had an office there. But I was very familiar with it. I wasn't as familiar with the crash or what was going on until obviously the news came out. And then I was like, oh, wow, this was crazy. But I was definitely aware of it. I mean, it was part of the DNA of like young startup sort of companies or like young professionals. You were totally. One degree of separation from a WeWork.
Totally. How was wrapping your head around all the, like, because the details of the crash especially are so financial and about like investments and, you know, I mean, I guess everyone can understand spending more than you make, but it is really complicated how it fell apart. And how was wrapping your head around all of that?
Yeah, I think it made sense to me once I sort of got the gist of it. I mean, my sense, and I'm not an expert in the technical machinations of what happened, but I think the real shame of what happened toward the end was more so that everyone had invested their time and energy in the stock itself. Mm-hmm. And I think everyone sort of put all their eggs in the basket of what that IPO was going to be worth. And it's a dangerous thing to do because when your company's valued at $47 billion, all of a sudden your tiny little stake becomes a fantasy. You know, I have 0.0001% and I'm still making $100,000, you know? So I think that can get really intoxicating. And I think that's what really creeped into everyone's subconscious was like, you just start making up those fantasy numbers. It's like, what mm-hmm. would you do if you won the lottery? Except it feels very tangible, mm-hmm. But it's really not tangible until an IPO hits. Until then, it's all fantasy and speculation. And I think that sort of, and it really intoxication is the right word, that intoxication that sort of seeped into the culture and seeped into Miguel and seeped into, you know, the other executives, really, I think, led people astray, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that people really got hurt in that. Miguel got hurt in that. Everyone sort of got hurt in that when that started creeping into their personal dynamics and into their psyches.
Yeah. So your background as an actor is really interesting to me. And I think for a lot of people watching the show, they have not seen you act before because you are an actor, but you're a lot of other things too. Yeah. And you had the climb as this kind of big, you know, Cannes success. And then the release came out during COVID, which I'm sure was very strange for you too. So were you trying to pursue other acting roles after that? How did that wind up? How did this wind up being the next step for you after that movie?
Yeah, I mean, acting is hard. You know, and I wanted to pursue acting at a younger age and it just was not viable. I had a family and it just didn't work out for our situation. And I was trying to pursue work that I could make money at, to be honest. So I got into commercial producing and then commercial producing segued into producing independent features. And then that segued into sort of writing and producing. And then that segued into The Climb, really, was the first time I'd mostly been producing up until then. And that was finally a chance for me to cast myself and take a swing on myself. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? And that was afforded me an opportunity that most people don't get, which is to like get a shot at it, be a lead in a feature.
And in a feature you have a lot of control over, you know, the movie that you want to make.
Complete control over, which is really refreshing, and complete control in the outcome and the tone and how I perform and all those things. And that was really a luxury. And then, you know, I was pursuing acting. I was pursuing everything. We've been marching lots forward. We were writing a ton. We were producing other projects and documentaries, and we were still moving all of our yardsticks forward. But I was definitely like, I want to act. And mm-hmm. people were still like, who is this guy? You know what I mean? And even if people know who you are, it's still a challenging place to be because it's just hard. You know, it's hard to get a job. It's a very slim sliver of actors who get to perform at this level. And so, you know, I was pursuing it and not succeeding I was pursuing it and not getting roles.
Sure.
As a lot of actors do. Mm-hmm. And then this one came up unexpected. You know, I did an audition just like I do all the auditions that come my way. And then it happened to lead to a role. So I find myself lucky again, I think, in this, in that it's sort of luck combined with, you know, obviously your talent and what you bring to the table. But there's always an element of luck, I think.
I mean, I listened to a little bit of Miguel McKelvey, and you do sound like him. Like, you clearly did more research than I do. Like, do you think that how much work did you have to do to really embody him? Or do you really think that there was a resemblance there from the start?
Yeah, I mean, there's a physical resemblance which helps. And there's a sound resemblance, sort of, which helps. I mean, I did different things during the performance to manipulate myself a little bit more to be in both his cadence and his register, and sort of his jaw moves a little differently. So I would do exercises to sort of move my jaw differently. And I had a sort of a set of things I would do before I performed each day to sort of orient my physical space into his particular space. But it didn't hurt. You know, it didn't hurt that I was a tall, weird dude from Oregon.
I was thinking about the Oregon thing. That was fascinating to me because his origin story in Oregon, I assume you didn't grow up on a commune, but you know, that's a nice coincidence for you.
It was a great coincidence. I mean, I grew up around a very tight knit community of mothers. So I did actually have a strange sort of the maternal thing. Really. I mean, my father was around, he worked a lot though and was gone often. So I remember being raised mostly by, you know, my mom and four other mothers who both had boys around the same age in our small town. And we sort of became a clique. The boys sort of became almost brothers to me. And so I was very much in line with sort of that orientation and could find pieces of it, if not as extreme as his upbringing was.
Yeah.
So that was interesting.
I mean, you're playing a real person who is a lot less well-known than Adam and Rebecca Newman. I mean, you're still clearly going through the efforts to really capture him. And I think you've been careful to say, you know, this is a version of the story. This is not trying to be documentary truth. But what do you owe a person when you're playing a real person in that way? How much time do you spend thinking about that?
Yeah, I don't think it's a good place to be to say you owe anyone anything, because I think that's just a rough place to get as an actor. I think the best thing I could do was to sort of assimilate everything I knew about him as a person and represent that as honestly as I thought fit for the role. Mm-hmm. So there are liberties. There's liberties taken in pieces of the script, which I was aware of, you know, because I understood my backstory, pretty detailed backstory. I mean, I built back a pretty detailed outline of exactly the chain of events and those kind of things. And not everything lined up, because it doesn't make for good cinema. Or, you know, you'd have to put 40 scenes in where it'd be better as one scene, you know. Mm-hmm. So there are inherently in telling stories, you consolidate and you simplify or you change elements to sort of suit your needs. And to me, I think that I felt more obligated to play the character correctly than I did to try and find a sense of like complete authenticity, because I don't think I could ever do that. I think it's weird to say I could be another person. You know what I mean? Because I'll never be another person. I can only be an actor representing what I think that person represents in the story.
Can I assume you have not heard from the real Miguel or anyone else in the show has?
No, I haven't.
Would you want to?
I always thought it'd be interesting. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if they want to talk to me. I don't know what their sensibilities are with it, but I'm completely open to it. I mean, I find the whole experience of creating art to be incredibly thrilling and sort of a creative endeavor. And I feel like fundamentally they're very creative people, all of them. And I think it'd be an interesting conversation to be had, but I'm not pursuing it because I feel like that's stepping outside of the realm of privacy, which I feel like I would like to respect.
Yeah. So you make a movie, The Climb. It's completely within your control. Pandemic hits, you're auditioning for things. Then you wind up, you know, say on the set for the third episode, the summer camp episode, with it seems like thousands of extras. You know, it's still a pandemic, so maybe it wasn't really. But, you know, as you step into this role and the size of this production, like, what is that like for you, having been making films as long as you have and been involved in them? What shift was making We Crash like for you?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple things. One, coming into it, just focusing on acting. I mean, in the other one, I produced it, like really produced it and acted in it. So like my arrival to set would be, you know, at 5 a.m. and I'd be trying to figure out where to fucking land the truck. Sorry, I don't know if I can swear. I'm trying to figure out where I land the truck. You know what I mean? And like, and stressed out about that and being like, well, what's happening with art? And we're missing this thing. And this is not what the frame looks like. And we can't lay dolly track. And then it's like, all right, now I'm acting. And that's like a crazy experience.
Yeah.
And then rewriting lines and figuring it all out. And then when I was on this one, it was like, great. I got in a transpo vehicle and I was driven to this place and I had like a trailer, which is a novelty for us, an independent film, and then like moved from the trailer to the set. And that I think was just a different experience, you know, but it was nice to focus on just acting. You know, I showed up mm-hmm. and all my attention, all my preparation went towards that thing. That being said, I was like, not at all prepared for the scale and scope of this thing. I mean, I should have been, but like when you step onto a set that big, summer camp was insane.
Yeah. Crazy.
I remember getting on the van and then we were driving to set and we just entered this world. There was like giant pools and thousands of beer bottles littering the ground and like tents as far as I could see, literally rows of tents as far as I could see. And then giant tent. And I was like, what is going on? You know what I mean? And it was a little humbling. It was humbling there. It was humbling walking into the set they built for the actual office. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's three, sto- I mean, it's two stories, but there's a middle floor. And then outside it's a three-story waterfall with trees and buildings. Like it was just the scope and scale of the thing was unreal. So it helped me in that sense, in that I had no choice but to be like, one, I had to deliver because I was like, damn, if I don't deliver.
It's really expensive to reset this take if I flub my line.
It'd be really expensive. And then, it was like, I just found myself lost in it because I was like, well, I guess I really am at summer camp. Like I literally walked around the set and I was like, I'm at summer camp. And that really helped me get into it because I really felt myself in all these places. So it was a blessing all around. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So you're now in production on 80 for Brady, which I don't, you know, I assume you don't want to talk too much about, but is this the first film you've directed?
Yes.
Okay. So how has that transition been? The climb to We Crash to this, it feels like a very fascinating transition to me. I'm sure in reality, it's many more turns in that process. But what's that been like?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because everything feels like it's all happening at once, and it's not really ever how it happens. Like, this has been in production, we've been working on this for 5 or 6 months. So, like, it all sort of has been, it didn't all just happen at once magically. Yeah. There was a tremendous amount of work put in on all of these things. But it is interesting shifting gears. It's funny because everything informs everything else, truly. Like, producing, and especially producing independent film where you're very creatively involved in the process. It's not just the technical side of, you know, either the finances or, you know, the logistics. You're really involved in the creative choices of all these things. And it's so intimate and personal. I sort of got to learn from the experiences of other directors whose films I've helped make. Mm-hmm. And that's informed how I work. Acting has informed how I deal with actors. So all of the things sort of feed into each other. You know, this is a big production that we're on. And I feel like I'm constantly learning all the time, to be honest. I try and really consume knowledge in real time, especially from other human beings, because I feel like there's really a tradition of passing on knowledge person to person that is really powerful. And it's not to say I don't read books or I don't try and avail myself of how to do things, but there is always something to be learned. And so I'm doing my best guiding this ship and helping my actors to their best performance, while at the same time, you know, always learning and always trying to improve myself and my process and how I create images, you know, and how I create performance.
Is there something specific you can think of that you learned, you know, working so closely with Jared Leto in this performance? You know, it's really transformative in a lot of ways. There's a lot of, you know, accent work and contacts and wigs, and either as an actor yourself or as a director, you know, acting alongside someone who's doing that kind of transformation. Do you learn something from that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot I learned from both Jared and Annie. I mean, both of them are consummate professionals, and the other actors on set. I mean, the deck was stacked. We talk about Jared and Annie, but the deck is stacked on talented actors.
Yeah, America Ferrera is coming, for listeners who haven't seen America the fourth Ferreira's episode yet, which is amazing.
Henley's coming. You know, there's a lot of incredible, Anthony Edwards is there. Mm-hmm. I mean, the whole thing is incredible, down to the assistants. All the assistants are like really talented, well-heeled actors. So there was a lot to learn from everyone. I think from Jared and Annie specifically, I think the real discipline and dedication to the craft is the level at which, the detail at which they would go into every character and every choice, and the detail they demanded not only from the directors and the writers, but the other performers around them to align to those things. But the detail that they would apply to those things are something that I really learned from, and it's something that I could sort of take across the boards is, you know, to feel, especially as a director, to make sure that I am equipped to answer that level of question.
That's interesting.
Of detail in a scene where they're saying, you know, the scene is simple. It's you're having this one little conversation in a boardroom, but it's like, what's the motivation? What's the blocking motivation? What are all the characters sort of things doing? What are the dynamics at play? And really focusing on that level of detail. And I can't say I'm perfect at it, but, you know, the just knowing that that's the level at which these professionals work really makes me, you know, made me in particular for this up my game. So I was as prepared as possible.
Yeah, and then you go and work with, you know, Tom Brady, one of the most famous people on the planet, which is
I'm sure an entirely different thing. Lily Tomlin, Jane Fonda, Sally Field, Rita Moreno. I mean, people that whose experience I can't even fathom. You know what I'm saying? As performers and human beings, each one of those people holds treasures beyond belief in their performance and in their soul.
Yeah. Are you surprised that this is where you've landed, you know, 3 years since that can? Like, does this feel like a logical place that you would have wound up? Because it seems pretty incredible to me.
Yeah, it doesn't seem logical at all. But what is logic these days?
Well, if someone asks you what you do, do you say you're an actor, director, producer, writer? Do you have one clean answer for that?
I don't. I'm always confused by that question. I always just say I make film, you know. I make film and I'm doing something in there, some piece of something in there, but it's hard. It's also like, I'm trying to be a little humble here. You know what I mean? I'm a novice in all the things you've listed, in the sense that like my track record is just beginning, and I intend to be very successful in all of those things. But a little of me has to continue to stay humble until I get a little further along.
Well, back to Recrash, maybe for the last question. Is there, for people who've, you know, seen the first three episodes, is there anything that we should look forward to that you get to be part of on the show? Either a big crazy moment like camp, or just a moment that you're proud of?
Yeah, I mean, I think it gets really exciting when money starts coming in, and before it sort of gets sketchy. There's sort of this playful wildness that seeps in. And you know, when you give young, wild, naive people resources, things get a little wild. And those were some of the scenes I really enjoyed as a performer, because it was like we were just letting loose and stuff happened. And, you know, we would scream and things. It was just wild on set for those episodes. And to me, that was sort of the most fun. And then things sober up, which is also fun to watch. But as a performer, you know, things got very sober very quickly. So
as well, they probably should.
As they should. As absolutely they should have.
Well, let's shift away from the Newmans and head over to the West Coast. In episode 5 of The Dropout and episode 3 of Super Pumped, we see more of the wheels come off of more of the buses, I would say. In the case of The Dropout, which has, I mean, the most emotional episode yet, I would say, at least from one perspective, you have an actual really serious consequence. Maybe not exactly directly caused by Elizabeth and the con she's pulling, but certainly related to it. I'm talking, of course, of, you know, Ian Gibbons dying by suicide in this episode. Did you both know that was coming, or did either of you manage to be surprised by this revelation?
I remember reading a story in Vanity Fair a while back in which they had interviewed Ian's wife, and she spoke about the death and how Elizabeth didn't reach out after, except to have someone ask for the computer back and other property from Theranos. So I had vaguely recalled that, but this of course reminded me of that tragic turn. What about you, Katie?
Yeah, I had spoiled myself on Wikipedia by accident, kind of watching the earlier episodes, and I had read Bad Blood, the John Carey Rue book, so I had clearly just forgotten it. But I think as this episode goes on, you kind of sense it coming, right? You know, knowing that, you know, this the most sympathetic character on The Dropout, I think, and knowing that something is really poisoned from the root as Theranos, they're incompatible, and that was going to end badly, and it's so sad and really well played, I think.
You see, you know, in the third episode of We Crash, like this young woman who's going through the motion, you know, and she becomes sort of one of the vampire victims of the Newmans. And then here we have someone who's really closely associated with Elizabeth and with Theranos, who not exactly, she didn't do it on purpose, obviously, really, you know, demoralize him and alienate him. But like, she kind of has to step over a lot of people, you know, especially the people who start questioning what she's doing. And I think the chilling thing is knowing that Theranos still moved forward past this is that it's going to affect her for a moment, but like, she's going to snap back into the con pretty quickly. And I think probably already has by the end of the episode.
Yeah. Yeah. That moment of her with the finger puppet, you know, where she has gone so far ahead of her skis that she's made these ridiculous puppets for kids getting their blood tested at the Theranos thing, which she knows the thing doesn't work. And she's just kind of staring at that rather than dealing with this very real emotional consequence. I think it tells you so much about where her head is and isn't in that moment.
Yeah, and we also see her meet with marketing people, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, the company, great, but we're more interested in you, you know? And I guess that's kind of where that whole public cult of personality started. Obviously, within the company and with Walgreens, that people are plenty in her board of directors. They're already well and truly invested under false pretenses in the Holmes narrative. But now it's going to start more and more turning outward. She's going to be written about. And I'm really intrigued to see how that unfolds on this show and how we see them scrambling to sweep things under the rug and all that. Because this is really when the House of Cards starts falling, is when there's just too much public attention on this and it can't withstand that scrutiny.
And it's interesting how she reacts at that moment, because she I don't think she's being falsely modest when she's like, no. Like, I'm not the face of this thing. I think she does feel uncomfortable there. And you compare it to on Super Pump this week, where Travis Kalanick is like sitting in a waiting room at a VC firm and kind of like peacocking his way to intimidate all the other people. Like, he is so happily using himself and his face and his hair to market himself and his company. And Elizabeth is not there yet. And, you know, maybe she never was. She had the whole uniform, but who knows how comfortable she ever felt.
I would love to get a psychiatry team to evaluate the psyches of these three founders. I'm just endlessly fascinated by what their breakdown must be. Just I don't even know how you survive something like Ian Gibbons' death and then pivot on that and run a company. I feel like there must be some element of delusion necessary to run a company and pursue a tech startup like that, but it's a lot.
Well, they're also, these people are so good at compartmentalizing and rationalizing and just being like, well, yeah, that was related, but you know, but they snared themselves, they made the mistakes that, you know, we see in Super Pumped when John Zimmer, one of the Lyft founders, says to Bill Gurley, he's like, you keep giving him, Travis, these wins, and he thinks he deserves them, and when there's one loss, he's going to feel like it's the end of the world and he's drowning, and he's going to step on you to get above, you know, get to the surface, essentially. And like, we don't see Elizabeth doing that ruthlessly exactly, but like, she is still doing it because nothing can distract her or Kalanick or the Newmans from the narrative. And I think it's really scary to watch. And I think in this episode of The Dropout, it's like, for me, it was the pivot point of like, okay, now I've moved pretty far away from empathy or sympathy with Elizabeth.
Right. It's a real turning point.
And you've got William H. Macy, who is not more despicable than her, maybe, but pretty despicable as you know, Fuse, the guy who's suing her, and how he just kind of keeps getting punched down by David Boyce, who's eating Cheez-Its in that last scene, which I love Cheez-Its. I'm right there with him on that. But just contrasting those characters, and you might have been rooting for Elizabeth before, but you see how she's crossed a line in beating him by the end of that episode. And then Laurie Metcalf comes back in. Thank God.
Oh, she's the best.
Yeah. What a welcome respite to have her back in. But yeah, the Richard Fuse stuff is funny because, you know, he's complaining to his wife and he's like, if she'd only just asked me for help, you know, and it's a sort of more high-minded way of it's like, you know, the mafia guy walking in and be like, eh, nice place you got here. It'd be a shame if it burned down. Basically, he said, oh, you have an idea? Well, I've now patented things, so now you have to do ball with, you know, play ball with me. And it, so, but he, of course, again, compartmentalizing, can rationalize it away and say, oh, no. I was just, you know, here to be a listening ear and offer wise counsel, and she slapped my hand away, which is not at all what happened, or at least what we saw happen earlier in the season.
Oh, yeah.
Knowing that ability to compartmentalize and to sort of manipulate people, I again would love to see a reality show where you put these tech founders on an island together and they somehow have to battle it out. But I would just love to see them interface with each other in any scenario.
Oh, fully. And I think that's what's a really kind of, you know, for me, the most electrifying part of this week's Super Pumped was this tete-a-tete between Kalanick and Zimmer, and then Zimmer and Gurley, because we're so in the Uber bubble on this show, you know, this episode is really concerned with Lyft, but we're still in the inner sanctum of Uber. We're still following Travis around. And then to have another, you know, big time tech entrepreneur enter the picture and they actually dialogue with one another, and we're able to point to one and say, I think he's a little better, is really fascinating. So I fully endorse the tech billionaire survivor, Julie, that you just pitched.
Perfect.
Yeah. Although credit to the other moment of Super Pumped where he meets with Larry Page at Google, and it's like this highly anticipated meeting, and it's Ben Feldman, a.k.a. Ginsburg from Mad Men, is how he'll always live out of my heart, in a really wild wig that seems very true to life, who's, you know, silent throughout this entire meeting, basically, until he decides to talk. And you see Travis kind of on the back foot, which is not a common position for him, and really trying to win this guy over. I think that brings out a more interesting aspect of his character, if not necessarily someone who we want to root for in that scene.
Well, because even people like that have a hero, you know, there's someone above them, you know, I don't know that Travis is so single-minded like Elizabeth is, like she's Steve Jobs. That's her, you know, I love that scene in The Dropout where she's like, you know, since we lost him, and they're like, did you know him? And she's like, well, no, not personally, you know, Travis might not have exactly that one hero, but certainly a Larry Page, you know, who is worth, I looked it up, over $100 billion at this point. Would be someone he would be willing to prostrate a little bit in front of, you know. He's not, and then of course, then I don't know, maybe I'm reading too much psychology into this, but then because of that and riding high on the fact that it worked, they got this huge investment from Google Ventures, then turning and really slapping down his puny competitor, you know, I think those are really connected on the same short line.
Mm-hmm. I'd go work for Lyft.
Are we going to get to see Amanda Seyfried, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and Jared Leto have a conversation together, a round table about playing these entrepreneurs? I would love to see that.
I mean, we do work at Vanity Fair, and Vanity Fair gets very frequently shouted out later on in We Crash. So are we just giving ourselves this assignment to make this dream come true?
The real trick is to get them all together with the actual people and see how that plays out. We'll start with the actors and then slowly introduce the real folks, and then all six of them can have an insane conversation with each other, because
we wait until Elizabeth Holmes finishes her jail sentence, and then we'll get there.
Who would you trust the most with your investment?
Ooh, I guess Uber is the one that is still solvent, you know. I mean, I guess WeWork is still solvent too, but throughout some weird crashes in there. What about you?
But I think the thing about that, that's a good question, Julie, because we've seen now three episodes, and really in this episode where Gurley now is on the outs, his access card has been shut off because he had the temerity to, like, not even go rogue, but just sort of speak autonomously about his own knowledge set at South by Southwest and say, you know, we're going to have some dead unicorns. Like, we've seen routinely that Travis is awful and really difficult to be, you know, even amicable business partners with, because he's, you know, an egomaniac who flies off the handle and all that stuff. And so, I don't know, I find myself being like, so wait, why would anyone do business with him? And the thing is, because they did have provable growth, you know, Uber, for all of its sins, and, you know, certainly one of those big sins is how drivers are compensated, was on a path to genuinely returning investment to people, you know, whereas the other two, WeWork, which is still functioning, but like was operating at a massive loss for a long time, and I think probably and still is. And obviously Theranos was just, you know, a complete snake oil thing. So yes, if push came to shove of those three things, that Uber, like, you know, even though Travis is an asshole, like he would make me money, I guess.
Julie, does it make you glad you're not super wealthy and don't have $100 million to give to any of these people?
I mean, I guess that gives me one perk to not being super wealthy. Yeah, I mean, I don't. That's one problem I don't have to deal with. But it is just interesting to me that these investors, like Bill Gurley, have to evaluate. And again, they are seeing the growth of these businesses, but evaluating these people and these personalities based on just gut, even though, you know, they're dealing with billions of dollars. There's something so incalculable or immeasurable about what they have to do and gauge in all three of these personalities.
Oh, here's another question for you guys. What do you think would happen if Elizabeth Holmes's brother Christian, who went to Duke, I don't know if you heard him say that he went to Duke, what if he met Travis Kalanick? Like, who would come out of that room alive?
Oh boy. Ooh. Well, no, I think he'd come out like, you know, Kalanick's like Igor or something. Like he would be fully in his thrall, and that would be that. Yeah, the brother it sort of suddenly introduced like that on Dropout was funny. I kind of liked that because it reflected the way that maybe people at the company would be like, wait, who are you all of a sudden?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting watching her making it a family affair, especially because she knows this is all a house of lies. And she's willing to bring people into that. Whereas the Newmans, you know, Adam's sister's there. Obviously, you know, Rebecca are married and she's getting involved. Like, they're buying it. You know, they believe it. Whereas Elizabeth, I can't really. I mean, that's a real cruelty, is to ensnare your unsuspecting, albeit, you know, a little bit obnoxious brother into this whole fiasco.
Well, and it also hits toward another real tragedy of Theranos coming up. You meet Tyler Schultz, George Schultz's grandson, who takes a job at Theranos and, again, spoilers for real life, but winds up being one of John Carreyrou's big sources in his kind of landmark piece that took down Theranos. And that was a family rift that never really healed. So I'm interested to see how much Tyler we get as that story kind of unravels.
Right. He goes up against his grandfather, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And his grandfather died relatively recently, and they, you know, kind of never resolved it. It's sad.
Right. And Tyler wanted to speed up Carreyrou's reporting because he wanted his grandfather to have a chance to reclaim his reputation after the company went down. So it was sad.
Yeah. And that scene where, you know, Tyler comes in and is such an eager sort of fanboy, you know. And you're thinking, oh, how nice, this young man is like really excited to meet this woman that he had, you know, idolizes, which unfortunately, you know, horribly doesn't happen often enough, in the world. And there's this paternal thing between, you know, the Schultzes, but also toward Elizabeth. And it is a personal scene. It's a family scene. It's not a business scene. And yet they're also interlinked, and then everything goes awry. And all the while, Elizabeth knows that her machines are exploding and they're going to break into the Siemens machine and steal their tech, essentially. And yet she just allows these things to happen because this is part of the narrative, just as the finger puppets are.
You see that great moment at the end where she's convincing herself of it, where she's like, it's just phase 1. It's phase 1. We're just going to do it for now. And I think, to me, that's the most convincing argument for why she let it go on so far, is that she had fooled herself into thinking that they were just going to do it for now and then it was all going to work someday. And I like watching that delusion build over time.
Right, incrementally.
Yeah, I mean, and it's similar to We Crash, where, you know, a soul, like, tech thing where it's a website or an app or whatever, like, that, you know, that is of that world. But, like, the big mistake, one of the huge mistakes that Elizabeth made was getting into the medical industry. One of the big mistakes that the Newmans are making is getting into real estate. Those are old, not fixed necessarily, but those are whole other systems that they don't really know anything about and yeah. yet are trying to manipulate. So if only these you know, charismatic weirdos had just decided to build an app, I mean, one of them probably wouldn't be going to jail, and the other, I don't know, well, I guess the Newmans are still plenty rich, but he might still have his company, I guess.
Right. Yeah. Or if the Newmans had not tried to sell it as more than a real estate company and claimed that it could change the world, if they had just, you know, been fine operating within that box, maybe.
Well, right. If the wing starts talking, you know, about world domination, then we should worry about that. But so right. far, other minus some controversies, very valid ones, you know, other co-working spaces seem to be doing just fine without this, you know, larger messianic purpose behind them.
Even though WeWork is probably still, you know, it's the Kleenex of co-working space. You go to a WeWork, even if it's not a WeWork.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, so I guess they won in the end.
Accomplish something.
Well, I think we have covered five episodes pretty well. Unless anyone does, Julie, do you have any more weird facts, or did you get all your dirt out?
The one thing I was going to mention is that when Gwyneth Paltrow won her Oscar, she partially dedicated it to Rebecca's brother, who died of cancer. I did not know that, so I have to go back and watch that Oscar speech.
Twist my arm to watch someone's old Oscar speech.
Right?
Any day.
But I think that was my
best. The thing is so wild. It's just like, I mean, you couldn't write that, you know, you couldn't make that up. Like, it's just such a perfect, it's not even a detail. It's a huge facet of this whole person in a strange way that it's just, it works beautifully on the show. And I think it's funny watching Anne Hathaway, like, pretend she's not a famous movie star too. You
know? Mm-hmm. Right. It totally informs who she is. And also, if, you know, Friday, when Friday comes along, Vanity Fair's Savannah Walsh is publishing a piece about Gwyneth and Rebecca's relationship. So definitely check out vanityfair.com for that.
Yeah, and credit to the writers and the creators of We Crashed. Drew Covello and Lee Eisenberg created the show. The way that they incorporate Gwyneth, a little bit in that first episode, but in the wedding episode of people just saying, is Gwyneth coming? And she gets increasingly impatient. It's just there's so many things you could do with that information. And I think they deploy it just the right way on the show.
All right. Well, that does it for this episode of Still Watching Downfall of the Startups. Katie, Julie, thank you for being here. Katie, where can people find you when you're not on this podcast?
Well, I'm launching a production of The Seagull in a warehouse space down the street, but only for a couple more weeks. So please catch me there.
And you're playing the characters, is that right?
Yeah. All of them in the original Russian, which I don't know yet, but I'll have it down.
Yeah, figure it out.
You can also follow me on Twitter at Katie Rich.
And Julie, how about you? Where can people find you?
I am on Twitter at Julie W. Miller. Also, by the way, we didn't even talk about Jared Leto, how he calls her Baba Ganoush. I love the pet names, but we can get into that on a different episode.
That's, all right, change your Twitter handle to Baba Ganoush. Yeah. Well, I am at Rylaws. I, of course, do run a summer camp up in the Adirondacks if people want to come. It's just me drinking a lot alone. So, you know, I'd love the company.
Out of a canoe.
Bring some Thai food and some soy sauce. This episode was produced and edited by Dave Gonzalez. And until next week, happy investing.
Hey, I'm Brian Stelter, host of Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. This week, with the help of Dan Adler and Olivia Nuzzi, we're going inside the media circus swirling around Donald Trump's criminal trial.
People want coverage of Donald Trump. They're sort of shades of 2015, 2016. I found it to be a total break from the reaction to a lot of Trump coverage in the last 2 years.
Join me, Brian Stelter, on Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. Listen wherever you get podcasts.